Last week, if you're with us, we talked about feelings. We're looking at about page 111 in the book. We didn't quite finish up the chapter. You may remember that in that chapter about feelings, you had some anger. That was from Mike Randall. We mentioned he has reached the point now where he felt like he needed to press the matter, and we're going to see some more pressing tonight with the next lesson. Let's pick up with Romans 6, verse 17. This is at the bottom of page 110. You have the verse in full at the top of page 111, but that God be thanked that you were servants of sin. You've obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine which was delivered to you. Four basic points there, four key points. Number one, you were a servant of sin. You were in a bad way. But something changed. You were, past tense, a servant of sin, but he says you did something. You did what? You obeyed from the heart. Well, obedience is possible. These Christians, these people who did become Christians, they did obey. He says you obey from the heart, that is, it was sincere. You were thinking about it. You were focused on what you were doing. And then he says, what'd you obey? The plan that you devised? He says, no, it was that form. It was that pattern. It was that system of doctrine. Now, several here have or are currently involved in some manufacturing process. And when you think about the business world, isn't there usually some kind of system, some kind of process, some kind of form that you follow? Where do we find that in the world? How does it exist? Well, let's go even more basic. You go into your kitchen tonight. Now, you might be the exception, and if you are, don't answer the question. But don't you think that most people have a system in their kitchen? Wow, three or four answers all at once. All right. Let's try to sort those out a little bit. Who wants to take the first stab at that? You have a form in, all right, Jeff?
Cookbooks.
All right. And usually they're not all scattered. When you go and you find cookbooks in a kitchen, they're generally on a shelf, or maybe there's a cupboard over here with some cookbooks, and over here there's a system. What else? Kitchen. System. Form.
Dishes.
All right, dishes. Generally, the cups, somebody says, well, the cups are in that cabinet, the saucers are over here, the plates are over here. You don't find one cup over here and then another cup in this cabinet and then there's a plate over here and a plate over there. It just doesn't work that way. People have a system. Where else outside the house do we see a system? A form, a pattern. Where do you see it in the workplace? Steve?
Well, if you're talking about manufacturing or trailer factory or whatever, there's a tool crib. They got all the saws and hammers and whatever in one location. Generally, they need actually, I know people have tool belts and they...
Yeah, you don't find tools just strewn around the factory floor. You've got a crib, and you have somebody in there that is authorized to keep track of the tools, pass them out, and collect them, and so forth. Can you imagine a factory that... Anybody ever go through an RV factory as far as... And some have worked in one, obviously, but anybody ever walk through an automobile factory or an RV factory? All right, probably at least a third of us have. You know, you've got the beginning line, and then as you walk through, you final get over your final line and your final finish and so forth, and there's a system. Can you imagine what it would be like if there was no system? You just have people show up, and they just start grabbing parts, and, well, let's kind of put it together. It doesn't work. Jeff?
I was going to say, even at the most basic, people have prints. They may not have written documentation, something, but you have these prints.
Yeah. Building a house. Any kind of fabrication that you're involved with. There is a system. There has to be some kind of assembly line, some kind of plan. And that's what God's done. He's not just said, you figure it out yourself. And you throw it all together and it'll be fine. Glenda?
I was going to say, we have shop cards for every order.
Sure.
And they have tabs on them and stuff. And a cab is what the box is supposed to look like and how it's folded and where the indentations are and everything. But I have to file those in numerical order every day. Now, some days my stack is that thick. Some days it's that thick. But it's just... that system, they have to be in numerical order.
Yeah. Kids, you look at school. There's a system there. There's a system for getting them to school. There's a system for getting them home. There's a system for caring for them. There's a system when it comes to the lunch program. Everything is regulated. God's done the same thing. Romans 6:17. He says that form of doctrine which was delivered to you. Who do you think did the delivering?
Christ.
Well, or God. Deity. Sure. All right, then Randall says, you must obey from the heart that form of doctrine which was delivered to you, Mr. Mike. Paul said that to become a true Christian, we must obey from the heart that form of doctrine. Now, if that's kind of a new concept for some people, they're probably going to ask about that. Well, what does that mean, form of doctrine, that system of doctrine? Well, if you were to have that discussion with someone, especially after you've discussed Romans 6, verse 17, you might say, let's think about the world. Let's open up your drawers and cupboards and see if you've got a system. Well, yeah, everybody's got a system. Well, that's also true in the spiritual realm. Okay, the form that was delivered, what was the form? It was that form that was given in the first gospel sermon that was preached, Acts chapter 2. And that, of course, was the day of Pentecost. About halfway down on page 111, he says, and this is, I think, a point which is worth paying special attention to. He says, Randall's Bible knowledge was vast. Can you be 100% sure about that statement?
How do you want to define vast?
Yeah. Now, if you are a non-Christian and you're talking to someone who's a Christian, and they're fairly well versed as far as the first principles, what the Bible says about faith, repentance, conversion, and the church, and how to go to heaven, those kinds of things, you might have all the answers and be able to snap them off 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. It's just like saying, if you can say all the ABCs, are you a master of the English language? Well, probably not. Now, you might be. But just because you can recite the ABCs of English, that doesn't necessarily mean that you are qualified to become an English teacher or that you're going to go out and write some great literary masterpiece. So you have Mike having a discussion with someone who certainly knows a lot about the first principles of the faith, and maybe he knows a lot of other stuff too. I don't want to diminish his knowledge. But just bear in mind that as we talk with people, sometimes they may have the impression that depending on the subject matter that we're talking about, they may know a lot less about a matter than we think. You know, you happen to go up and talk to somebody in a hardware department and you ask them about a particular size or screw or bolt or nut, whatever that is, and he knows that right off. Well, maybe he had to figure that out at his own house the other day, and he really doesn't know much about hardware, but on that particular point he knew exactly what to look for, or he happened to find that in the last day or so and knows exactly where to lead you in the store. So this was his impression, and sometimes non-Christians have that same impression today.
Right.
I'm sorry?
I can't figure out which chapter that was. Didn't it say further through, one of the chapters we've already gone through, that Randall's knowledge wasn't just picking up Bible verses and things like that, that he even knew how they were used and how you
Yeah, I think that's
the background to a lot of them.
Yeah, I think that's probably a fair deduction when you go back to the, I think it was last week's class where we talked about the fellow who had been talking about faith alone and that had been a doctrine of more than 50 years. He has some bits and pieces of knowledge which would seem to go past what you might would necessarily associate with first principle. So I think he probably was pretty well schooled. He probably could have talked about Bible manuscripts and so forth. But just as kind of a reminder that people will sometimes associate more knowledge with a person than they may have. But in this case, yes, I do think that he probably was well-versed in a lot of areas. Anybody else? Okay, let's go back to page 111, about halfway down. Randall's knowledge was vast. His respect and love of God was evident. He was not disparaging me. He was simply trying to teach the truth of the Word of God. He says, going back to the sinner's prayer, and I suspect you already know that the sinner's prayer ain't in the Bible, said Randall. His grammar didn't fool me. He was a very intelligent man. And what did he say? Well, I'm still looking. You know, one of the things that can help a little bit, you'll find sometimes this is done maybe by, maybe not so much a hostage negotiator, but there's a situation where something comes up. I use this in a devotional article today. There's this fella, he calls up this guy, and the guy says, wrong number. Well, that was before the fella even had the caller ever had a chance to say anything. And he thought, well, that's kind of weird. So the guy who was doing the calling was a cop, and he thought, you know, being a cop, I'm kind of curious. So he calls him up a second time, and the guy says, wrong number. So this goes on about four times, and with the fourth time, the cop finally gets a word in edgewise and makes the point. He said, I figured out why you're always saying wrong number. Anybody know the answer to it? Well, come on, with this many people.
Situation at home you couldn't talk about?
No, the guy never got any calls.
Nobody ever called
him. So on that fourth call, the cop said, I figured it out. Nobody ever calls you. You probably need a friend, so I want to talk to you for a little while. And that kind of caused the guy to step back and think, wow, you know, this is either a crazy person or somebody that's probably worth talking to. But that kind of response, it caused this guy to kind of rethink things. And sometimes a little bit of humor or something like that that'll cause a person to step back a little bit and rethink things. You'll see it sometimes in a hospital. Doctor will come in. People are real serious. Am I going to die or do I have this deadly disease? And maybe they'll crack a little joke or they're trying to lighten the mood a little bit. And I think you see that here with Randall and Mike. They're trying to lighten the mood a little bit. So I'm still looking, I replied, without any real conviction. So Randall continues to keep it light. He says, I'll tell you what, while you're searching, do this. Anybody know what he asks him to do? Gives him some information about who? Well, Saul of Tarsus or Paul, and that conversion. And he says, look, this guy, since this chapter is about feelings, that was a logical place to go. This fellow also thought that he was in a right relationship with God, and God needed to have a little conversation with him. That conversation did take place, and you can read about him on the Damascus Road. And there you'll also get some more information about the sinner's prayer that it's not in the Bible, and you'll get some more insight on how to obey the gospel. He makes the point, as you look at the next page, 112, Mr. Mike Saul did not become a Christian by saying the sinner's prayer. He didn't ask Jesus into his heart. He didn't claim to have a personal relationship with Christ or any of the doctrines that we've talked about that are similar. Randall said that how? He said that softly. So once again, trying to lighten up the conversation just a little bit. Then he smacked me on the shoulder and said what? Check it out. See, again, you can kind of see that was a jovial send-off. As I walked toward my office, I thought I was happier when I was religiously stupid. Do you think there are a lot of people who are like that in the world? Yeah. There are a lot of people when it comes to not just religion, but other subjects. They wish they were still in the dark. Can you think of some examples? I sure wish you hadn't told me that. Okay. Every once in a while, I get hungry for the hash browns from McDonald's. I don't know if I'm ever going to get another hash brown from McDonald's. There was a story the other day that said they have found some indications that parts of golf balls are in hash browns. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. No, really. This is real stuff. Yeah, really. I don't know if that's real or not. But, you know, the next time I look at a hash brown, I'm kind of thinking, was that out in the back nine, you know? So I would have been happier. Yeah. Yeah. A lot of things you could say going through the drive-through there, but I could have been happier not hearing that. So sometimes it's food related. What else? Happier if I hadn't heard it, Brent?
Andy Griffith and Aunt Bea didn't get along. Something like that would just ruin the show for people.
It is, and especially over the last few months, they've come out with some of the TV characters and stars. You saw, what was it, Joni from Happy Days? There was some information about her, which was kind of sad. And the other day, Ellen, was it Ellen from the Waltons?
Mary.
Not the...
Aaron.
Oh, it was Aaron, yes, thank you. I was trying to think, which one was it? Aaron, some information that came out about her, which was kind of sad. And you read that because you're curious, or at least I do, and then when you go through the details, well, there were drugs and this and that and the other thing, you think, how sad. Anything else, Marcia?
A family member confides in you that they're having marital problems.
Sure. Right. Sometimes it's a relationship issue with a spouse, or sometimes it's a problem with the child and so forth, and it's distressing. Sometimes we need that information, but still, it's not something that we really enjoy hearing. Anybody else before we... Micah?
Work.
All right. Yeah. They're shutting the place down, or you
no,
get...
Not.
Yeah, that wasn't it. Just, I was happier when I didn't know, so... Yeah. Well, especially if you're packaging up something, you might go back to the eating category. You work there, and it's kind of like, well, it might go out the door, but it's not coming to my house. So there have been times where that has definitely taken place. All right, he says, yes, ignorance is bliss, but spiritual ignorance is eternal damnation. And that is exactly right. It's no laughing matter. I remembered again this statement. It is easier to believe a lie that one has heard 1,000 times before than believe a fact that one has never heard before. And that lays a great foundation for the next chapter, Snake Bite. Once again, anything that somebody wants to add or ask before we pick up with chapter 15? Okay, let's take a look at page 114. We'll still be reading probably about a third to half tonight of the material. He says, what I did not know was that my best friend Larry and Randall were studying the Bible together as well. Now, here's where the plot thickens a little bit. You sometimes you're talking with somebody, maybe it's a work situation, and you think, I'm going to, you know, have this conversation with so-and-so and sort of keep it on the side, and nobody's going to know. Well, there may be another track there as far as a Bible study. The person that is talking to us, remember we talked about Randall? What did we say about him prospecting? Did he have his sights on more than one person?
Yes.
So he's thinking about other people, but if the guy's talking to you, your attention is probably focused on that study, not so much what may be going on around you. But God operates sometimes on many tracks.
You've been working with Mike here for quite a while.
Yeah.
And you really wouldn't think that he would just bypass somebody else if you're just going to try and work with Mike. He needs to put feelers out there for somebody else also.
Yeah. It's, again, the business world sometimes is a great teacher when it comes to spiritual matters. And you might be, if you are in the business of trying to bring in customers or clients, you might be going after this customer, this account, this client, and that's all good and well. Maybe you'll land that customer, and maybe you get the account, maybe not. But whether you do or not, if you're a good business person, what do you not want to do? What's the old saying? Don't put all your eggs in the one basket, the same basket. So, yes, work with that customer, but at the same time, bear in mind that you have other people out here, and they also merit attention. So you see that he's using good, judicious judgment in this way as well. All right, so Larry's spending a lot of time over at their house. That next paragraph down, Larry was a very clean living guy. He stayed away from the poisons of life, tobacco, alcohol, etc. His family were Presbyterians, therefore he was a Presbyterian. Here's a practical point for us. Here is a guy who is a religious guy, to some degree. And not only is he a religious guy, more to the point, he is a fellow who is living what kind of life? A clean, moral, good life. In our religious climate, a lot of people would look at that kind of person and say, well, hey, what's my attitude towards you?
You're not going to listen.
Well, what could be? But you've got a church home, trying to do right by your family, not involved in anything that is especially noteworthy, not doing anything that's probably going to put you on the police blotter. So spiritually, where do we put you? Yeah, we don't feel that there's any kind of need to talk to you about spiritual matters. And Randall was smart enough to realize that here was someone else who deserved some attention. He deserved to see what the Bible taught when it came to New Testament Christianity, and that's exactly what he did. All right, moving down to about halfway down the page, and once again, this is page 114. But Larry did what? He hid the fact that he and Randall had been doing what? Studying the Bible together. Now, can you slip a Bible passage into that? Over there in the book of John? Not chapter 4 and not chapter 2, comes right in the middle. John chapter 3 and the story about Nicodemus. He came to Jesus when? By night. Now, maybe he was busy during the day. Or maybe he had some concerns. When you find that people start asking questions about the Bible, oftentimes how are they going to ask them? Openly? No, they're going to ask them when nobody else is around. Slip you, hey, let me call you. Let me send you an email. Let's make this private communication somehow. Because I don't want anybody to know. I don't want to be embarrassed. Now, if somebody, I think the question probably doesn't need to be asked, but we'll go ahead and put it out there anyway. If somebody comes to you in that kind of way, what should be going through your mind as the potential teacher? Person comes to you by night, or secretly, so to speak. All right, I think seriousness is one of the items that, I mean, works a full day and then he's going to follow up on this, so taking some time off time to check things out. So serious, that probably would need to be foremost in the mind. What else, though?
Keep him in your confidence.
All right. Treat him carefully. The golden rule. We want to make sure that we treat people in a good way. Do you think that somebody who acts in that way could be easily spooked? They're coming by night, so to speak, or coming secretly, so probably not really good to go and, hey, let me tell my coworkers. Well, that's not what he wants or she wants or they want, and that's not what we would want if we would be in that same set of circumstances. So bear in mind, you know, people in today's world oftentimes, you know, we grew up, as did several of you, in an area where neighbors talk to one another. At night, neighbors would go out and spend some time at one another's house. And, you know, you might be there until dusk. Come on in after you've sat out on the porch for a little while. Those kinds of things. Very pleasant. But when you start looking, another article that I laid out today was some information about loneliness. And that was, well, I guess that was tied in with the illustration I gave you earlier. But we live in many respects, a very lonely society. People are afraid of reaching out. If they do get enough courage just to reach out a bit, the last thing that we want to do to those fingers that are reaching out is what? Hit them or chop them off. So bear in mind the kind of world that we live in. Bear in mind how cautious sometimes some people are about reaching out, especially younger people. And when they do try to reach out, be as kind and as considerate and as helpful as you possibly can. That's how Christ would treat people. Anything that you want to add or ask? Okay. Let's pick up the bottom of page 114. Mike, I've got some news I wanted to share with you. I can't wait any longer. Larry spoke as I motioned him to sit on a wicker bungalow-type sofa. Well, spit it out, I said impatiently. I was baptized today. Now let that sink in for a little bit. If you're Mike, you've been talking to Randall for a long time. Larry is also on this religious track, so to speak. You didn't know it. And he comes over and says, I've got something to tell you. Wow. That's probably a pretty big shock. And it certainly was for him. You can see at the top of page 115, you what? Question mark. You'd almost expect an exclamation mark there too. The words trailed off as I asked, I didn't even know you were thinking about religion. Now.
Well, see, Larry knew that Randall was talking to Mike.
Yeah. Yeah. So he was a little sly about that. It was kind of like, well, okay, let's get a little additional information, but I'm not. Yes, he was. He played it very close to the vest. So, skipping that next paragraph, Mom and Dad aren't very happy with me, Larry said with sadness. And then that last sentence in the paragraph, but I have to do what the Bible says and do what the Lord wants me to do. We see that in the Gospels, don't we? What did Jesus say? The enemies that you're going to have are going to be the people where? In your own family, in your own household. And that's sad, but there are some things that sometimes divide people, and one of the items that divides people is truth. You also find sometimes that error divides people. There probably were some big name cases before this one, but the first one that I really remember was Patty Hearst. You go back in history a little bit and you find groups that got involved with someone, a family member, and that separated the family. Sometimes it's a murder situation, but in this case, we're dealing with spiritual matters, and it has separated a lot of families. But, Larry, I objected. How can you be so sure that you've done what the Lord wants? Now, isn't that interesting? If you've been in most of the classes, we've gone over the objections little by little, and we have noted how Randall has been so careful with Mike, just logical argument after logical argument. He's built things up almost like you're building a house. Given him a good foundation, put the walls in and everything, and now Larry comes along and he's going back. This is a strange phenomena when it comes to people. Kids are probably the best example. You can tell a child, let's say the child has a self-esteem problem, and you can tell the child, you do well, you're going to be okay, and everything goes okay, and then something else comes up, and then that's okay too. And then something else comes up, and they get through that. And maybe you go through this 8, 9, 10 times. And then when time 11 comes up, you as the parent are thinking what?
He's got it.
We've solved it. He's got it. But lo and behold, they say, well, hey, Mom, hey, Dad, what pops its ugly head again? The self-esteem issue. Now, why people keep going back and repeating that stuff, I don't know. But it's just like they get into a cycle of thought and it can't be broken. And sometimes that's what you'll see when it comes to spiritual things. Person can be, I'm guilty of that too sometimes. There have been some passages over the years where I have revised my view. And if that revised view is not immediately, if it's not foremost in my mind, if that comes up in a Bible class, guess where my mind goes back? As far as discussing that verse. Yeah. There are some items in the book of Genesis that, you know, I went back and thought, no, that's not right. It needs to be looked at in this way. And yet when that comes up in a Bible class, it's kind of like, okay, we're going to have to, you know, sort that out again because it's just not quite fully clicking. And that's what you see here with Mike. He goes back and he says, well, how can you be sure that you've done what the Lord wants? So you have him. He grabs his Bible from the top of our wicker bungalow coffee table. He flips through the pages. I look at the wall clock. What time is it?
9 o'clock.
Anybody know about what time they finish up?
4 or 5 o'clock.
Almost 6 the next morning. So they had an all-nighter. From that point, we discussed, we argued, and reasoned the scriptures together throughout the night. You may not have had this exact experience, Teresa and I, after we became Christians, shortly after we became Christians. We were running for a little while. Teresa had found this group. They called it Mark IV. And the Mark IV group was a group that was sort of interdenominational. They had just about everything you could imagine. Now, there were probably some really far-out groups, but, I mean, you could find probably some Pentecostals and some Catholics, and you could, you know, go down and look at some people who probably wouldn't get together religiously or get along too well religiously under normal circumstances, but they all kind of came together and set aside their differences and had some devotionals, and we started to run with that group for a little while. After we studied the Bible, and after we concluded that baptism was for the purposes that we find described in the Bible, we were baptized. We then began to discuss that information with members of the group. And we went from being part of the inside to the outside almost immediately. And they didn't shout us down, and they didn't physically attack us, but they made it very clear that they believed that we had been deluded and that we were involved in some kind of works-based salvation, and we did not feel like we were very welcome. And at that point, we pretty much parted company with the group. So we did leave behind some friends. And several years have passed between that incident, and I can still remember, and I'm sure Teresa can as well, a couple of those meetings. Several years have passed between what I just described and now. And even after some decades have gone by, trying to reach out to some of those folks, it's still a very frosty relationship. There is really no relationship for me. And with Teresa, she'd gone to high school with some of them. It's distant. I think that's probably the best that we can say in the greatest of circumstances. So when you start looking at what Jesus said, you know, you're going to lose some friends. Family is not always going to stick with you. He wasn't kidding. And when you look at what we have here, this is exactly how it works in many cases. Anything that you want to add or ask before we move down a little further into the text?
Why was it called a Mark
IV? I've wondered that several times. My guess might be because in Mark IV you have the parable of the sower. Now there are some other things in there as well. But just that the seed was scattered, and maybe the thinking was that the seed has scattered in all these different religious groups and we're kind of all growing together. We never together figured out why they chose that particular designation. That's one of the great questions I guess we'll just have to die with. But so far, no answer. Anybody else? Okay, let's go back to 115. Larry was educated. He was accustomed to due diligence. So a lot of people can be involved with due diligence. Sometimes some educated people don't do too well with that. But it's important to be diligent, and certainly that's true when it comes to Scripture. He had also presented these same arguments to Randall during their Bible study. Now, bear that in mind too. When people say, well, I don't believe that for this reason. Is it possible for somebody to come up with a new argument? If they're going to look at something that the Bible describes and they're going to deny it in some way, do you think it's possible for them to come up with some kind of new argument that's never been used by anybody before? It's possible. But even though it's possible, it's probably not probable. Because 2,000 years have passed. And, you know, that's a lot of time for a lot of creativity. So just about everything under the sun that could be argued as far as some kind of defense against some part of the truth, somebody, somewhere, somehow, in some form, has probably tried it. And Larry had tried it. Randall's tried it. Randall's going to go back and do it again. Well, we know some information about the thief on the cross. We've already discussed that. And what's the big objection to the thief on the cross? Some would go back and say, well, look, the thief might have been baptized. That's possible. But what couldn't the thief have done? Remember Galatians 3:27, for as many of you as have been baptized into Christ. Well, when could that have started? Right? Jesus has got to go back into heaven. You know, he's got to be raised up from the dead. And when you look at the thief, what's the status of Jesus? Well, he's dying on the cross. He's still alive. So you can't be baptized into Christ. That's not possible yet. So somebody comes along and says, well, the thief on the cross. We'll be glad to talk about the thief on the cross all day long. But let's make sure that we understand where he died in time. And that is, he died under the Old Testament system. And now we have a new system. And that was one of the things that Larry had picked up. That should be one of the items that we try to cover with people and explain. I've said it before in this class. I'll say it again. If you can teach people that there is a difference between the Old Testament and the New, just Malachi is where it ends, and then Matthew through Revelation, that is the system under which we live today. For a lot of people, that is an eye-opening thing, and it clears up so much misconception. Which law are we under? What's true for a giving? What's true for the thief on the cross? What day of the week do we meet on? Do we observe the Passover? Do we observe the Lord's Supper? So many factual points come from that single teaching.
Yeah,
so that, well, remember, when they wrote the books, the New Testament was in place. Jesus was preparing for that. And that's why you have John the Baptist and even Jesus sometimes saying the kingdom is at hand. So you do have some preparatory information for the kingdom there. And we use that preparation, that preparatory information. Now, for example, we talk about the golden rule. When did Jesus speak that? Well, that obviously was spoken before he goes to the cross. But we look at that as a Christian teaching. Why? Well, number one, it was written after Christianity, probably about 30 years or so, 20 years or so after Christianity came into being. And it was something that Jesus intended for his people to follow. But yes, you do have some of that information spoken prior to the cross.
I point out to him many times that Christ was not a Christian. He was born and raised
as a Jew. Is it you?
And most people that I talk to mention that he wasn't a Christian. Where did Christianity come from?
Yeah. Yeah, and as again, as people just, they need to, once they see it, it makes all the sense in the world. But for them, it's kind of like, well, I never really considered that the Bible can be split down the middle, so to speak. But you're right. Paul, in the Galatian letter, said that Jesus was born under the law and lived under the law.
The commandment he gave to go into the nations, be baptized.
Sure.
That was given under the Mosaic law, as yeah. far as that goes. But it was still his commandment that when I die, these are my commandments.
Right. Yeah. The new birth. We often talk about the new birth from John 3. But once again, when were those words spoken? Well before Jesus went to the cross. He cites at the bottom of page 116 verses, which are very, very helpful. Ephesians chapter 2, verses 14 through 16. Colossians 2, 14 through 16, also very similar but very helpful. Paul said, for he's our peace, who hath made both one, and hath broken down the middle wall of partition between us, having abolished in his flesh the enmity, even the law of commandments contained in ordinances, for to make in himself of twain one new man, so making peace, and that he might reconcile both unto God in one body, the church, Colossians 1:18, by the cross having slain the enmity thereby. The enmity, of course, was the law under the Old Testament, that first system. The Jews, for a good part of that system, were God's special people. Now each one who obeys is a special child of God. Then Larry revealed another biblical point. He said, I'd never considered. He brought up one of the many reasons for baptism found in Romans chapter 6, verses 3 through 5. Paul said, don't you know that we were baptized into Christ, and that means that we were baptized into his death. We're buried with him by baptism into death, that like as Christ was raised up from the dead by the glory of the Father, even so we also should walk in newness of life. If we've been planted together in the likeness of his death, we shall be also in the likeness of his resurrection. The thief did not have that experience. He could not have had that experience. We, however, can. Then you also have, from Matthew 27, verse 51, bottom of page 117, what major event taking place in conjunction with Jesus' death? The temple, what happens there? The veil, you have that thick curtain that's ripped in such a way to indicate that division between Jew and Gentile, all people could now have full access to God, and the Old Testament law was going to be done away with. Anything that you want to add or ask before we look at 118?
Okay. The Ark of the Covenant was in the temple when the destruction of Jerusalem happened.
Well, the Ark had been gone for a while, Glenda. The Romans came in and got what they could get. They burned a lot. So if, you kind of have, for example, in the Old Testament, some people grabbed the Ark for a little while and held on to it. Had that been available in the first century, I don't know exactly what God would have done had the Romans tried to grab it. I think Providence probably ensured that that was not going to happen, and that didn't turn out to be an issue. But when you have pagan people, when you look at the Maccabees, you can find, like a Catholic Bible, they would have the apocryphal books. I'm going to put it, I might be a little off in the dates, but I'm thinking around 168, 170 AD, you have some pagans coming into the temple area and defiling it. They sacrificed swine there. And when you look at people like that, with Isis, I think even there, you have a modern example of that. They will go to a so-called holy site, and what do they want to do? They want to defile it. They want to do something that's going to somehow foul the site. If you look at some of the art, and I use that word hesitantly, but there have been some very vile things that have been done in the name of art. There was one a few years back. They took a jar of urine, and they took a cross, if I remember correctly, and turned the cross upside down in the jar of urine, and everybody thought that was just great art. But it's that same mindset that whatever we can pervert or twist or destroy. I've not read it. I don't have an interest in reading it. I've heard, though, that when you look at the Satan's Bible, it has the same kind of stuff in it. It will take some items that will be associated with God and flip it on its head, so to speak. So that just seems to be satanic, the reverse of what's right. And with humans, there are some people who seem to get a great deal of pleasure out of that kind of activity. And the Romans, well, I mean, look at what they did with Jesus. So you can imagine whatever treasures they could have found in the temple area. Again, just if you know, you can mock the king of the Jews, so to speak, then yeah, they would have had great fun with that. Well, they went in there once a year. We can take a look at that. It's been a little while since I looked at that as far as when the ark disappeared. But I'm going to just talk off the cuff here, but I believe that by the time the people came back from the captivity, the ark was gone. So, you know, you're talking in excess of 400 years that it's been out of commission. So it's, you know, we don't have it. Well, you can still have all the furnishings there for the inside of the temple. The brass laver and so forth and the place to sacrifice. But, you know.
But the ark was to be God's presence behind the curtain, was it not? For them to go in and for the priests to go in and offer the yearly sacrifice once a year for all the
sins of the people. Well, but if God's taken away the ark, you have two choices. You can continue to the best of your ability without it, or you can just shut things down. And they continued without it. So, but yeah. That had to be distressing for the people. But yeah, it had been gone for a while.
Okay. I missed, when did you say he took the ark away?
Well, I don't know that I can give you an exact date. But I think that you can build a reasonably good case by the time the Jews came back from captivity. That would be southern Israel. They're coming back from captivity. You've got the restoration. Let's see, 722, the north was taken away, 586 for the south. So, yeah, 400 plus years when they came back, the ark is no more. I mean, you know, you're drug off into captivity. You're a slave. They're not exactly going to let you pack everything up and say, you can continue to worship here, and we'll just make a new temple for you.
So God decided that, like, when the Philistines had it, they set it up by their idols, and it fell over, and, you know, they put it up again, and it did that. That just didn't happen anymore, and the ark was...
When the invaders came, Glenda, I don't know. Did God remove it? Did people bury it? Brian?
I think of Daniel 5 with Belshazzar. He had the utensils from the temple. And you would think if they'd taken the utensils, why wouldn't they have captured the Ark of the Temple?
Yeah. Yeah. So, did they take it? Did the Hebrews maybe bury it? They knew that there were invaders on the way. There are a lot of questions that we could ask and a lot of possibilities that we could give. Did they maybe try to part it out? We just don't know. But like I said, it had been gone for a long time. And they just had those two choices. They could either make do with what they had, or they could say, well, the ark is gone and, you know, religion is not going to continue. But
Jesus still called the temple a holy place.
Yes.
So he knew that it wasn't there.
Yeah. And Mary and Joseph still went there. You have Jesus teaching in the temple. So, you know, Judaism still continued. You know, you have the restoration. For example, when you go back and you start thinking about Nehemiah, you start thinking about Haggai, some of the Old Testament prophets. But let's also not miss this point, that we can get a lot of focus on the ark. But what would that have done? God says, let's protect the ark. And you guys come back into the land and we're going to get the temple going again and everything is great. We've got this cranked up and everything is wonderful. What's the problem with that?
You make it harder to do away with Judaism.
Yeah. It was already tough enough for a lot of the Jews to shut it down. But you remove that 400 years. That's a major symbol. So they're still kind of going along. And then you, with the temple, yank out the curtain. In the book of Acts, you have some priests who become Christians. You've got all the miracles. And if that doesn't work, you finally come against Jerusalem in 70 AD and you decimate the city. And there's nothing left. So it seems to me that God issued a series of successive blows against the people to show that something's happening here. You may not have it all figured out, but little by little, and then finally he gets to the point where he says, okay, this is, we've definitely come to the end. The curtain's fallen and closed.
I have read an article that Solomon and Queen of Sheba have a son together. You know, this is or either here or there, but that he had it in his providences. I saw it was interesting.
Okay.
Before they were taken, the bronze serpent was destroyed because it became an idol. And if we just continued on with the ark, that could become more of an idol for them to worship it.
Yeah.
I think that is the total salvation and not Christ himself.
Yeah. And again, there had to be that gradual moving. The law was designed to corral the people, to get everything lined up so Christ could come into the world at the right time and do what he needed to do. And, you know, God did it in the right way. Anybody? Dolores?
Correct me if I'm wrong, but there were really no commandments of things that they had to do to or with the ark. It was more of an honorary memorial. That, you know, when they had to sacrifice the animals, they used the brass basins and, you know, on the stands and everything, but there really wasn't anything that... was there anything that they absolutely...
You have some items in there that I don't know that they had to be touched once they were put in there. I would associate the ark more with a sign of God's presence and blessing. Yeah. And maybe the Jews were able to sell that. Look, okay, we don't have the ark, haven't had the ark for a while, but we do have the temple.
And they were already in the land.
Yes.